Hello and welcome to another road edition of Turned Out a Punk. I'm your host, Damian Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had the life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, someone who helped invent it, from the band Blondie, the legendary Clem Burke, a.k.a. Elvis Ramone, producer of many power pop classics, including the Speedies and the Colors, and just a legend. There's no other way to put it. More on that in 1 second. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, hit up the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire, Tristan Abraham, and he will get the message to me. He also does a Facebook page and an Instagram page for this podcast as well. Both are Turned Out a Punk. You can find me on Twitter or Instagram at LeftForDamian to support the show. Tell your friends about it. You can also hit up turnedoutapunk.com and grab a t-shirt. Thank you to everyone who has done that. I've seen a lot of people wearing them so far on this tour that we've been on, and it fills my bucket to see you wearing those shirts. Thank you. You can also support the podcast by subscribing to it and rating it and letting all your, as I said, letting everyone know that you know that we do this podcast that they might enjoy. I play in a band, as you can tell from the audio. I'm on tour right now. I'm doing this in a hotel room in Denver, Colorado. We are called Fucked Up. You can find out more information at fuckedup.cc. And come to some shows. If you hear this, we've got, I think, 2 more shows left on this run, and then another one, and then, you know, who knows? Who knows what happens after that? And that's it. All right, on to today's show. Today on the show, Clem Burke is here, and it's funny because Clem plays in an incredible band, like a power pop supergroup called Split Squad, with legends, a bunch of legends, including my friend and former guest of the show, and future guest again on this show, more hopefully soon, Josh Cantor. And Josh and I caught up in Boston when I was on tour there not too long ago, and he was talking about being on tour with this band. I was just punishing him for stories that he had heard or just what it was like being on tour with these people. And I was just kind of lamenting the fact that I really wished Clem Burke would come on the show. Fast forward a few weeks and here's Clem Burke on the show. And it's a big thrill. Blondie has this brand new box set that has just come out, an incredible box set. It's truly like overwhelming to look at this thing. It's called Against the Odds, 1974 to 1982. It's got like tons of records, like 2 books, 7 inches. There's like 36 or something unreleased Blondie tracks on that. We talk a little bit about this in the interview, but anyway, I got to get my hands on a copy of this thing because it looks ridiculous, but I have not yet seen one in person. So I'm just going by these online photos. But if you're a Blondie fan, you need this thing. Holy, you definitely need this thing in your house. This looks ridiculous. It is on Numero Group. I never get that right. And it is also on UMC, and you can find it now in stores everywhere. And so, yeah, Clem came here to talk Blondie, and I also got him to talk a bunch of other stuff. I'm not going to ramble on anymore because you're going to hear it in 2 seconds, but that's it. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Clem Burke on Turned Out a Punk. Clem, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot, Damian. Appreciate being here.
Well, as I was just saying off air, I was recently wishing this would happen to our mutual friend, Josh Cantor. And now here it is happening. So wish upon a Josh and your dreams come true. So thank you for being here.
Right. And hello to Josh. Brilliant keyboard player. He's in a band with me called the Split Squad. We just recorded just put out our second album called Another Cinderella. And Josh and I were just in France not too long ago, traveling around in a van and doing a bunch of shows. We did a really cool festival in Bordeaux with the Schizophonics. Do you know those guys?
Yeah.
Yeah, they were great. Really great. I think they're from San Diego. Really cool band. And it was out in an open field in the city in Bordeaux. It was an amazing time.
Well, and also Kurt from the Fastbacks was playing with you on that tour, right?
That's right. Yeah, Kurt was with us as well, which was great. It was great to play with him and a legendary guitarist from the Seattle scene and a really cool guy. So, yeah, it was an interesting group of guys driving around in a van around France for, I think, 2 weeks or so. It's really fun.
Josh and I were talking about it, and it really is like a power pop supergroup when you have, you know, Plimsolls and yourself and Fastbacks, and you've got like a real who's
Keith
who.
Keith from the Fleshtones.
That's Fleshtones too, absolutely. Yeah. It's a real, like, I don't know, it's such a cool band because it does bring all these sort of like connected but disparate kind of power pop scenes that were springing up independently all over America together.
Right. And I think with the Fleshtones, I think I played on their very first recordings back in the day that led to their record deal with IRS and all that. So we've been friends for a long time. Fleshtones are a great band.
And also, didn't you play with the Plimsolls on a session?
I did. I played with the Plimsolls. We did an album called Cool Trash that came out quite a few years ago now. Yeah, right. I did play with them. And I kind of had this recurring theme that I'm become the anti-Spinal Tap drummer. You know, I kind of fill in
yes.
for the drummers that are not around any longer or not in the band any longer, let's say. But I did play with the Plimsolls and really great band. You know, that song Million Miles Away is kind of like a new wave classic.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to talk about hopefully a lot of that stuff, but I got to start off the way they all start off here, which is Clem, right. How'd you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the term?
Well, I think probably with Iggy, you know, with the Stooges. I mean, there was a group of friends when we were kids that all liked the Stooges, and I think they were referred to as punk at the time. And of course, along with sort of kind of garage rock, to me, was kind of punk rock, you know, like bands like The Music Machine and, you know, just on and on. I think the term was around in the 60s. I mean, I think that's when I first became familiar with it and as related to music. And I would say the Stooges were probably the first punk band that I, you know, really liked a lot.
Because you were heavily into music from a very young age, right? Like you had that one band that covered Zappa and Captain Beefheart back to back at a school assembly.
Right, right. Yeah, we did do that. And the music teacher pulled the plug on us.
Before you got to Beefheart? Or was it during the Zappa?
We were doing that song, Willie the Pimp. I think it's a Beefheart song.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah. And that was pretty funny at, you know, 10 o'clock in the morning, school assembly. But
Well, and obviously that stuff had a fan base, but it wasn't necessarily mainstream music. So where were you kind of hearing about music at that age?
Well, the people that I played with at that school assembly were all very much into Frank Zappa. And I think that album Freak Out, we were all into as kids. You know, we just kind of looked for the more sort of out there stuff. You know, we're listening to the Stooges, listening to Mothers of Invention. Yeah, I don't know. It just, the inception of my interest in music was very early on. So, yeah.
What was the root of the inception of loving it?
Top 40 radio in the States, you know, the playing, you know, at the time, things like Paul Revere and the Raiders or the Music Machine or the Stones. So to me, the Stones were kind of a punk band, really, you know.
Well, it's interesting to kind of look at them as being sort of the genesis of that sort of American garage rock stuff you're talking about and how it is like that is ultimately, the genesis of American punk rock.
Right, right. I mean, the Seeds, you know, Pushing Too Hard, to me, that's like a punk rock song. Mm-hmm. You know, Sky Saxon, I co-produced a record for Sky that was called King of Garage Rock that came out on Cleopatra Records a few years back. It was very interesting to work with Sky. You just don't want to let him know where you live, basically.
Rest in peace. Absolutely. Because he is one of those, from all the people that have come on this show that have had engagements with him, like one of those true eccentrics that, are kind of the root of punk rock in a lot of ways.
Yeah. Yeah. And Question Mark and the Mysterians, 96 yes. Tears, you know, they kind of sound like the band Suicide, you know, in some ways. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's
things like that, you know,
and how unhinged a lot of that stuff was, like vocally, people screaming and kind of like going different places.
Yeah,
what was Total Environment like? Was that the band that covered Zappa and Beefheart?
No, we were basically covering the top 40.
Okay.
Yeah, top 40. You know, that of the day in the sort of around 1968 or so. Yeah. but we were really popular in my hometown. And there was all these, you know, battle of the bands type things that we would play at and sometimes win. And that, all that, they're the band, the first band I was in the recording studio with. We recorded at WABC studios in New York for Cousin Brucey's Big Break, it was called at the time. The DJ Bruce Morrow, you know, would have solicit local bands to send in a recording of themselves, and then they would, if they liked that, they would put you in the studio, and then they would broadcast the track that you did in on air, and then people would vote, all that kind of thing.
That's awesome.
That was fun. Yeah.
So did you gig with that band a lot? Like, were you playing like dances, yeah, type things?
Yeah, dances, CYLs, you know, Jewish community centers. Excuse me. Yeah, the typical thing that most of my friends were doing at the time. I mean, if you, you know, investigate what Bruce and Steve and Vincent were doing back in the day, that's the kind of thing they were doing. And most weekends we would play and, you know, earn a bit of money. And it just kind of one thing led to another from there. You know, I was always in a band from the time I was a teenager, you know.
So by the time you moved to or start going to New York more to play shows, you're already doing Sweet Revenge by that point.
Yeah, well, before that, we would go into Manhattan to the Fillmore, you know, the C bands quite a bit, to the Fillmore East. And then when I had the band Sweet Revenge later on, was kind of like a glitter glam rock band, and we would play at a place called Club 82 a lot. And that's where I first kind of saw Wayne County and people like that. And a lot of people would hang out there that kind of eventually wound up at CBGB. People like Lenny Kaye or Tommy Ramone, Joey Ramone, New York Dolls would play. The New York Dolls, really, so that's the beginning of the whole New York scene for me. Of course, the Velvet Underground prior, but the Dolls were a band I would go and see, and everyone on the scene admired the Dolls, you know.
Yeah, they really do seem like, you know, like that famous thing about the Velvet Underground. Everyone that bought that record went and started a band, but it seems like, right, with the New York Dolls, everyone that saw them was inspired to kind of do it.
Sure. I mean, they were larger than life figures to me. They were like superheroes, the New York Dolls. And, you know, they were on the scene playing. You know, I saw them at Max's. I saw them at Club 82. I saw them at concert venues around the city. Famously, I saw them open for Mott the Hoople at what was called the Felt Forum at the time. And yeah, the Dolls were the ultimate role models for everyone on the whole New York scene, really. You know, I mean, the songs, they're really great songwriters. Of course, Johnny Thunders, Dave Johansson. The drummer, Jerry Nolan's a big influence on me as well.
Yeah, they're certainly one of those bands that, you know, those records sound timeless. Like, they're still fresh.
Yeah, it's just so funny when people would, you know, kind of say they couldn't play and things like that. It's just ridiculous, you know.
Well, I think that's like the big lie with punk, is that these people that were coming into it were amateurs that had never played before. And it's like, you know, everyone had been in bands prior, like from my understanding. You know,
I'd say most people were. For instance, when we began Blondie, famously, my first gig with Chris and Debbie at CBGB was with our bass player, Fred Smith, who was in... left that night, announced he was leaving to join the band Television. Mm. And so that was kind of like when things began to fall apart quite quickly for me with my partners. And then I brought in my high school buddy, Gary Valentine, who wasn't really a musician. And he knew a few chords, but he had never been in a band. He was more like a poet. He's gone on to become a quite acclaimed writer in the UK, writing books mostly about the occult. And I always run into all these people who always bring up Gary as his writing, for his writing and all. He's so he goes under Gary Latchman, which is his original name, but he writes books about like Crowley and the occult in, you know, in popular culture and things like that. And I know like Kurt Hannett and Johnny Marr, a lot of people always reference Gary's books to me when I see them. So but he wasn't a musician, really. He was, like I said, a writer, a poet. So I think he recited some poetry for his kind of audition in front with the three of us. And he went on to play with me, which we probably get to at some point, with Iggy. You know, we did a tour and Gary was one of the people involved at that.
And also one of the great power pop songs of all time, I Like Girls, that he did with the
He had the band The No. He decided he wanted to make his own way, and so he decided to leave Blondie much too early, and his kind of swan song was that song I'm Always Touched by Your Presence There, which we recorded on our second album, Plastic Letters. But I'm in touch with Gary to this day, you know.
That's amazing too, like all the different places people wind up, because here he is having this whole incredible act with Blondie, obviously, and then his power pop stuff as Gary Valentine, and then in The No. But then here he is having this whole other act where he's even probably arguably more famous for.
Arguably he is much more famous. I'm not particularly have that much interest in the occult, but I know he's, as far as people that are into such things, he's considered to be quite an authority nowadays. Yeah, it's amazing.
Who were some of the other bands that you would have been playing with Sweet Revenge? Like, was Milk and Cookies kind of part of this scene, or any of the pre-Ramones bands, or?
Well, that band, the Neon Boys, that Richard Hell and Tom Verlaine had played at Club 82. There was a band called Another Pretty Face that was kind of almost a Bowie tribute band that was quite popular. They would mix originals with covers like T-Rex. And I mean, the whole glam rock, David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust kind of really reinformed, you know, the beginnings of punk rock, for sure. I think everyone that got involved in the music scene was influenced, as they said, the New York Dolls, like David Bowie, Mark Bolan. I know Sylvain was a big T-Rex fan, for instance. Some of the other bands, like I said, Teenage Lust, there was a band called Harlots of 42nd Street, and Debbie and Chris had a band called The Stilettos. Those were kind of the other bands that were on the scene at the time. Yeah.
It feels like there's almost the sense of like waiting for punk to happen for a lot of the people that were there to get it going.
Right. There was a band Sniper too, that Joey Ramone was in as Jeff Stardust.
Yeah,
they were on that. They played on that circuit at the time. And there was the place Coventry in Queens, another club that people would play, but where Kiss would play, for instance. I think people were waiting for something to happen. It's almost like the whole scene at Club 82 kind of morphed into the whole scene at CBGB, with most of the people that hung around there kind of made their way around, virtually around the corner to the Bowery, to CBGB.
Did you ever catch that band, The Dogs from Detroit, that moved to New York for a short period of time?
I think I did. Yeah. At one time. I think so. I think I might've seen them somewhere along the way.
They're like
name's familiar.
Yeah. And they're like, I guess they played with Kiss at the show Kiss got signed at, and they would play very early on, just before punk kind of happened. They always seem like to be the wrong place at the right time, or the right place at the wrong time.
Right. Yeah.
And so
it's interesting with CBGB, that whole scene. I mean, many, many, many bands played there, but really the bands that had any kind of real success, I probably could count on two hands, really. I mean, you had Living Color come out later on out of CBGB, amazing band. But the early bands, you know, Patti Smith Television, Ramones, Talking Heads, Blondie, Ms. Mink DeVille. Yeah.
Well, it's fascinating because, you know, like you said, there's so many bands out of that scene, but there's so few that make it beyond a couple 7 inches, you know, and right. The bands that do are obviously some of the most important bands in the history of rock and roll. But it's amazing how many bands didn't get there. Like it's interesting reading, just, you know, even from your own accounts, like how maligned Blondie was in the beginning, and how it's kind of through this fighted doggedness that you kind of persevere. And that's why I think Craig Leon says it even in the book Paralleled Lives, but Blondie is kind of the first punk band, because you were the band that did it in spite of everyone around you discouraging it, and ultimately carved this incredible path that changes music forever.
Well, thank you for saying that, or Craig, thank you for saying that. But we had a really broad musical palette early on, and a lot of those attempts were not fully executed. You know, for instance, I mean, Heart of Glass, with the backlash that occurred, we thought we were experimenting with electronic music at the time. But, you know, that song was around since the mid-70s, on the first demo we did with a guy called Alan Betrock, who was the editor of New York Rocker. I think he's kind of started the newspaper at the time. And, you know, the songs on that demo, which are included on this Against the Odds box that we have coming out, never really saw the light of day other than being officially recorded, other than the Heart of Glass version of Heart of Glass. And it's funny enough, there was a song called Platinum Blonde, which is kind of like a, in the vein of the New York Dolls or the Rolling Stones. It was kind of Debbie's calling card at the time. And we've never really officially recorded that on any other Blondie record up to this time, which is kind of funny because it was kind of a trademark song initially when we were first playing in the bars around New York. It's funny.
It inspired actually a Canadian band from around where I'm from to, they gave them their name Platinum Blonde.
Oh, really?
It was on that bootleg, right? I think the guy Alan bootlegged it early on.
Alan Betrock, I think he put it out. Yeah, but now it's on the, it's included officially in this Against the Odds box. But
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a little demo we did in a recording studio in a basement in Queens in the mid 70s. Yeah.
Well, it's amazing how it's just like a little demo, but it's like these songs that would change the world. You know, it's like the ripples off this like one recording session.
Right. Oh, we also did, we were all big fans of the Shangri-Las, and we did a version of their song Out in the Street on that demo, which wound up being done with our record with Craig, No Exit. We included that version of that song on that album back when we got back together. But yeah, I mean, we, as I said, we attempted many things. Some were not fully executed until much later on. And so we had like this really broad musical palette, and the various influences of the band were all over the place as well, with you know, soundtracks, things like Nina Rota, Fellini movies, or like bubblegum bands like the 1910 Fruit Gum Company, and the influences of the Velvet Underground and the Stooges and that kind of so-called punk rock aesthetic, you know. And that was all kind of in the kind of melting pot of the sound of Blondie, I think.
Well, I think that's such a calling card of punk rock too, is that sort of like postmodern aesthetic where you internalize all these influences and but you don't ever disguise that these influences are there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, obviously the Velvets were a role model in a lot of ways, you know, mm-hmm. And that influence kind of is slightly there. Things like Ripper to Shreds on the first Blondie album, for instance. And we used to cover Femme Fatale and things like that.
Well, it's so interesting too, how, you know, you hear about this sort of divide that it was starting to happen in New York with like Patti Smith and Blondie. And I imagine you kind of trying out for Patti Smith at one time probably felt that divide firsthand.
Yeah. Well, Patti, you know, it's really she was the springboard for everyone. I think really her, getting signed, you know, in her, first record, that's so brilliant. And, you know, she, along with the band Television, you know, would play together at CBGB, and they created quite a stir, you know, like sold out shows, lines around the block. And they were the first ones to kind of to bring that to fruition there. And yeah, I mean, Patti's great. She's great. You know, it's yeah, I did had a brief audition with Patti. It was funny time. At the Blondie rehearsal studio. I think my partners in Blondie walked in while we were doing the audition. I was with Gary, you know. It's kind of funny, but Patti's great. Yeah, but there is that weird kind of one side of the CBGB's axis was like kind of like, you know, the Heartbreakers, Blondie, the Ramones, and on the other side, you had the Television, Talking Heads, Patti Smith kind of, it was almost like high school, you know, like cliques and stuff. It was rock and roll high school, you know.
But once again, that's the foundation of so much of punk to come out of it. Like, that's what I find so fascinating about that scene, is because obviously there's just a handful of you that are making up this scene, but these dynamics establish the dynamics that exist forever in punk and hardcore, where you have this sort of like double helix of street rock and roll and art school kind of coming together and creating something.
Right. Well, we had our basis in art school as well, with particularly with Chris and Jimmy, our keyboard player. They were both artists. And I was kind of more just into the just always wanted to be a rock and roll star. You know, I was on my quest to find the right place for me. And, you know, I've said many times I was looking for the person that to front my band, so to speak, that had the sort of, you know, creativity, the charisma, the power of like a Bowie or a Jim Morrison or, you know, people like that. And, you know, I thought when I found Debbie, you know, she was kind of that person. And I think that kind of what persevered as we continued with Blondie, you know, she became this really iconic figure. The fact that she was a woman made it a little different, you know, but I think there was kind of a yearning for the glamour of glam rock, so to speak, in the context of punk rock. I mean, the Sex Pistols were kind of like a glam rock band too, in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah. There's like a lot of talk of them trying to be the Bay City Rollers, or Malcolm McLaren saying that they were going to be the Bay City Rollers.
Yeah. I mean, that I can get that analogy, but that wasn't really where they were coming from. I think they were, you know, but matter of fact, you know, Glenn Matlock is now playing with us in Blondie on this tour that we're doing. And we're getting ready to do a show tomorrow night, actually, in New York. So, I've become friends with the three of them, other than John with the Pistols. So I have a history with them going back quite a way. Glenn and I have been friends since the 70s.
Well, and also one of the great underrated rock records, Checkered Past.
Right, Checkered Past with Steve Jones. Yeah, that record was not what people expected from Steve and myself at the time, I don't think. And Tony Sales, came out of playing with Iggy on the famously played on the Idiot and the Lust for Life albums. And along with a guy called Michael DeBar, who's a DJ now on Sirius and a friend of mine, and Nigel Harrison from Blondie, we had formed a band called Checkered Past that was kind of more like a hard rock band. And got a lot of flack from a lot of people because it wasn't what they expected. And then kind of most recently, a friend of mine was going through an old copy of that magazine Kerrang.
Yes.
And they had the best albums of, it was 1984. They had like the top 10. And the first one was like the Van Halen album, whatever one was out then, maybe the first one. Then it was Purple Rain. And the third album was Checkered Past. So some people liked it. Yeah.
Oh, no, it's one of those records that, you know, I'm sure at the time, if I was like a young punk kid, it wouldn't have been what I was hoping for. But at the same time, like hearing it now, you know, divorced of that expectation, that when your drums kick in on that first song, oh my God, that is a hard rock record.
Right. Is it World Gone Wild? I'm not sure if that's the first song or not. But
yeah, that's the first song. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a fantastic record. Like, once again, like, I think because people have these expectations, because it's amazing when you're in a band, and obviously you've had a much more incredible career than myself, but like how people fixate on different periods of your life, which are only really like a short period of time creatively, and then you're doing other stuff, but they become so idealized and fetishized to people at a certain point that it's hard for them to accept that it's like, well, no, I do a lot of different things.
Yeah, well, I was kind of used to that because of the backlash of Heart of Glass as well, you know, during the days of Blondie. Like I said, we thought we were experimenting. And, you know, when I went on to work with my friends in Eurythmics, Annie and Dave, on their first album called In the Garden, which we recorded in Neunkirchen, Germany, outside of Cologne, with the producer Connie Plank, who produced Kraftwerk. So when I met up with Connie, he was really forthcoming about how much he appreciated us using the electronics and having a commercial hit with it, you know, and he got the connection, the Kraftwerk influence in that. So I was really proud to have Connie say that to me. He was an amazing producer, produced Devo, and, you know, worked with Brian Eno quite a bit. And it's actually a really cool documentary that Connie's son did about him that you could probably find on YouTube, because he's not really very well known in the States, you know, but Connie Plank, who's a really great producer. He worked with us with Eurythmics on a few other things after that as well, on this album called Revenge.
I think people like, I think you're proven right on all these things that you suffered a backlash.
Well, in retrospect, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, nowadays it does seem like, I don't know if it's the whole shuffle phenomena that occurred during iPod's first coming around, but you know, it seems like there's music's all over the place in mm-hmm. a good way, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can listen to John Coltrane next to Iggy and the Stooges, next to the Rolling Stones, next to Marvin Gaye, for instance, whatever, and it all kind of seems to make sense nowadays.
Yeah, like I think it, at a certain point when you were paying for these things, there was a lot more sort of like religious devotions to the things right, you're paying money for, and now that it's all kind of like pay one fee, get it all.
I guess so, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
It's interesting to see what the music's going to come out like, because it will change it, right? Like that's the thing. People used to do such deep dives into certain genres mm-hmm. or certain areas, but now it's going to be a lot more far reaching.
Yeah. So I mean, the music's a lot more accessible, like you said. Yeah. Which is a good thing about that. Yeah.
You also produced two of my favorite power pop band and played in The Colors as well.
Oh, right.
The Colors and the Speedies.
Right.
Two super underrated groups, but were they kind of happening around New York and you saw them, or did they come to you because of Blondie, obviously, or how did that start?
Well, a bit of both. The Colors, I kind of tried to manage and produce them and got them some interesting gigs. I think they opened for the Undertones, for the Bay City Rollers, I think the Ramones even. They were the new kind of up and coming younger bands on the scene, and I had some time to kind of dedicate to helping out a few of those bands. And so the Colors just kind of became friends, and I wound up producing an album for them as well. And then the Speedies, I think once I started working with the Colors, the Speedies came to me about producing them. And I had a good friend at Electric Lady Studios that we were able to go into for the in the downtime in the middle of the night, I think. And also with the Colors, when CBGB installed a 16 track recording board, we would go in there after the bar closed at like roughly 4:30 a.m. and begin recording till about 2 p.m. It was a really strange kind of the night shift of recording inside that bar, reeking of the night before, you know. But it was Hilly Crystal was very supportive of the Colors as well, you know, the owner of CBGB. Yeah, it was just like a natural progression for me to kind of keep working with younger bands. And then they were mine as a drummer for a while, so I recorded an EP with them.
That EP is fantastic.
Yeah, that's really, I like it a lot. I think someone just did an article in the New York Times about those kind of second generation of New York bands that I think it just came out. It was primarily about the Speedies and another band, the Student Teachers.
Oh, yeah. Thurston Moore actually talked about him when he was on the show, because he was part of, that next wave.
Sonic Youth, of course. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because there's also at that time you have, in addition to these bands, I guess you have the more of the hardcore stuff also beginning to start.
Right. I suppose. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't associate them with hardcore, but Living Color kind of came out of that second wave, you know, and Ed Stasium, who produced them along, you know, working on the earlier on with the Talking Heads and the Ramones, did a great job on that Living Color record, that song Cult of Personality. It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. A fantastic band. And I think it speaks to like CBGB's eventually, you know, even beginning to be a place where those are, you know, Meet Me in the Bathroom era New York bands, like it was
right.
continually kind of like a cool space for new bands to go and play.
I think there was some kind of acrimony between the Strokes and Helio. I think I've read somewhere, someplace.
They definitely seem to be a band that was very divisive on the scene early on. They come up on this show and not necessarily in the best light all the time.
Yeah, that's a whole other story, but they were a great band. They are a great band.
They've got some songs, you know, there's no denying that.
Yeah.
Speaking of bands with songs, the Marbles, they were another band that I think was managed by Alan early on, Bettrock as well.
Yeah.
Were they a band that you guys would play with, or were they kind of like, you know, once again, a band that didn't really get far beyond a single?
We actually shared a rehearsal space with them early on West 30th Street. And I quite liked them because once again, they were kind of like a power pop band. The Marbles, they had some good songs. I used to like that band, the Poppies, too, that morphed into the Boyfriends mm-hmm. later on. But the Poppies were very much like influenced by the Cavern era Beatles, and they were on the scene and they were really good. I like them a lot, Poppies.
And you brought up Jimmy earlier, and he play with the Fast, or he had some connection to the Fast, right?
Well, Jimmy Destriar, keyboard player in Blondie, we originally met him through the Fest, you know, and they all grew up together in an area of Brooklyn. And Jimmy's sister was a friend of ours as well. So it was all kind of, you know, there was only that handful of people that were hanging around Max's and CBGB at the beginning, most of whom were musicians. And the Fast were a band that actually would play at Club 82 as well. And we used to cover one of their songs with Blondie called Comic Books. But Jimmy came to us via the members of the Fast recommending him. Yeah. But supposedly he played in that band Milk and Cookies for a minute.
Yeah, I think I read in the book that he got kicked out just before they went to England to do that first record.
Yeah, something like that. I'm not really sure. That's all kind of cloudy for me. I don't know. But we were lucky to get Jimmy at the time, you know. We were looking for a piano player. And, you know, he didn't have a piano, but he had to have a Farfisa organ, which obviously fit into our whole kind of bubblegum rock, kind of punk rock aesthetic. You know, it kind of immediately kind of brought in a sound of the 60s, let's say, to the band in a good way, you know, with incorporating the Farfisa organ.
It's interesting to think of how different it would have been if you had found a piano player instead, like how that would have changed, because obviously right. The Farfisa organ in Blondie is a massive influence in your
way. Early on, right, the first album, yeah, and yeah, in general, right, you're right.
And it's amazing to think how that change would have affected all rock afterwards, in a way, especially right. Punk.
Yeah, if you think about it. I mean, it harkens back to, you know, the question mark and Hysterians type of sound, 96 Tears, or, you know, the Little Red Riding Hood, you know, Sam the Sham,
yeah,
people like that.
I just took my kids to an amusement park yesterday, and they played Little Red Riding Hood as we were walking in, and it's just, it's such an over-the-top song to hear in a children's kind of environment.
Really, yeah. It's a kind of, yeah. Yeah, once you think about it, yeah, it's kind of yeah, I see what you mean.
When you went to that your trip to England, and you went to visit a girlfriend, I believe, and
yeah,
you
my also... girlfriend was going to Polytechnic in East London, yeah.
And so you were there, and you also checked out like Dr. Feelgood, I read, and became a big fan of Dr. Feelgood.
Yeah, I saw the Feelgoods a bunch of times while I was there. They were kind of like really riding the wave of their kind of biggest success at the time. And I was in, there's an album called Stupidity, a live album that I was present for the recording of. And I did see them play a few other shows along the way. And also I sort of became friends with Eddie and the Hot Rods. And there was a band, Cursell Flyers, that the writer Will Birch was in, and who went on to play drums in the Records later on as well. Will did. And yeah, that whole kind of beginnings of, I didn't see the Pistols. I mean, I think I probably was there when they were playing. So the Stranglers, yeah. But the whole kind of minimalist approach of Dr. Feelgood was something I was very appreciative of. And I also kind of saw the comparison to a band like Johnny Thunders and the Heartbreakers, for instance, you know, with the rooted in that sort of R&B. And the Feelgood style, you know, with Wilco with the black suit and the black red and black guitar, and Lee Brillo in the white skinny suit, and it was just like very appealing to me. And their energy was amazing. And you know, everyone acknowledges them as being the really true precursors of punk rock. You know, like the kind of the bridge from pub rock, so-called pub rock. Because I think the Feelgoods were much more aggressive than a lot of the pub rock bands at the time that were doing, you know, covers of American rock and roll. But then you had, you know, kind of the presence of kind of the beginnings of like Elvis Costello and Nick Lowe and things like that going on at the same time over there.
With Brinsley Schwartz, right?
With Brinsley Schwartz, yeah. But yeah, the Feelgoods, very influential, just their whole presence. And went on to see them in America a few times. Famously, they played at the Bottom Line, which is no longer there. It's an NYU dorm now, with was the Feelgoods with the Ramones opening. So it was like the greatest combination, you know, ever. You know, it was really amazing. And I think I saw the Feelgoods play up like in Hofstra University or something like that. we tried to talk to the guitarist Wilco Johnson, but he was, seemed very moody and didn't want to even be there at the time. So yeah, there's a great documentary about the Feel Goods. You've probably seen it, Oil City Confidential.
Absolutely.
Fantastic. Kind of spells it all out. Yeah, it's amazing. Julian Temple, great job on directing that. It's really, I think I'm in it for like a second too as well, I think. Because as you referenced, it's become kind of folklore how I brought that album back to the States. And we had a party, a welcome home party for me that we had in the Blondie Loft, and that record stayed on the turntable all night, just being played over and over. Everybody really liked it.
Well, I love that kind of cultural football that's being tossed back and forth between English rock and roll and American rock and roll, where, right. you know, and it just like that influence that you kind of have on each other's scenes. It's just so fascinating to look at. And I guess it goes right up until like bands like the Strokes, where you have, you know, them getting much more popular in the UK before they get popular in North America.
Right. Well, that was the case with Blondie as well. Our early success was in Europe and in Australia. But yeah, and yeah, we always kind of thought back to Jimi Hendrix, how he went out to England and became popular. So yeah, the Strokes are another band that definitely had the success in the UK much sooner and much bigger than in the US at the beginning, for sure.
Well, you know, speaking of UK, there's that famously terrible NME review that Charles Murray did of Blondie.
Oh, right. Right. Oh, Blondie will never make it and all that kind of
stuff. Like one of those.
Yeah, I know Charlie Murray. He's very opinionated, but he's written some good stuff along the way, but he was wrong about that. So
it's funny. It's amazing when you go back and read it now in right. a lot of ways. It's terrible in a lot of ways when you read it now, but also just how completely the inverse it got it with the history. But had that come out by the time you had gone to England for this trip?
Oh, no, that was a little later.
Okay.
The band was going, but, you know, I was telling people about the band when I was there, but it was very early on, you know, and that was the whole thing when I began to see bands like Eddie and the Hot Rods and Dr. Feelgood. I could make the comparison to what was going on in New York, because it was kind of pretty much completely underground at that time. You know, it wasn't really well known with CBGB and all that. I remember I kind of got a ride back from a gig with the members of Eddie and the Hot Rods. I remember telling them about the New York scene and about Blondie and bands like that, television, things like that. So it was very early on. It was before the media kind of picked up on any of it. And I mean, we were pretty rough, you know, that was the whole deal. We always kind of say the same thing about CBGB, how it was kind of like a workshop for us. You know, you're able to make your mistakes in public. And, you know, for better or worse, at the time, much of it was not recorded. You know, it was just kind of happened there in thin air and then it was gone, you know. So Bob Gruen was probably the only one who had the you know, looking
the black and white ahead, film camera.
You know, had the video camera, yeah, and had enough whatever word I'm searching for to realize this is probably something that's going to kind of continue, and it'd be great to document it. He was early on, documenting everything that was going on. I mean, that film that he made about the New York Dolls is amazing from all the footage that he had on them. But it was all word of mouth, you know, and so we could screw up. I mean, there's that footage of the Ramones arguing with one another on stage at CBGB and things like that. So, you know, it was a really like a workshop. So it was like an anything goes atmosphere, you know, so that was a good thing. Yeah, maybe he saw us on most nights were not that good with Blondie early on. There was always something screwing up. So, but I think we persevered, you know.
Well, and I think that's what's so punk about it, is because it is, right. It's real. And that, like, you know, the show might not be great, but it's going to be a real show. And obviously Blondie now is like, I saw you with Garbage a couple years ago when you came through Toronto, and it was, okay. it's still unbelievable. Like, the show is incredible, but like, there's still that honesty on stage where it's not like the Ramones where everyone's kind of got a costume on. And I guess, you know, Elvis Ramone, you would know this firsthand, but you know, with Blondie, it's the real people up there, and it's very authentic.
Well, that's nice of you to say that. Yeah, my time with the Ramones was brief, and I'd been asked to join many times. I mean, I was with Tommy in the UK when they were on their tour with the Talking Heads, when we were touring with Television on our first UK tour. And Tommy at that time had told me he was planning on leaving the band. He just couldn't take everything, the politics, the pressures. And he really wanted to just become what he had set out to become, a producer. And, you know, I was asked to join back then. And it was, so it was always, you know, Blondie was always going on. Finally, when I was asked to join, when I accepted, I should say, was a very strange time. Johnny refused. He wouldn't rehearse. I always make a comparison, like picking up a guitar for him was like picking up jackhammer. I mean, he was brilliant, but I don't think he wanted to know about rehearsing and things like that. He just kind of wanted an immediate transition from, at the time, Richie Ramone into me, Elvis Ramone. I came up with the name. I knew they were big Elvis fans. I didn't want to be Clemmy Ramone. So I said, hey, how about Elvis Ramone? And at the time, I didn't have my haircut like this. I had my, I'd been playing with Eurythmics. I kind of had more like a DA. So I go, how about Elvis Ramone? You know, so it's amazing that part of my history, although brief, always comes up. And I mean, the Ramones were, to me, the most influential band after the Beatles. You know, they're like the Beatles of my generation, of our generation, you know, so many, so influential in a particular sound, you know, and style. But I mean, I went to high school wearing a motorcycle jacket. You know, I used to get thrown out for not wearing a tie and wearing a black leather jacket. So I immediately related to the way they looked, which is really, they were just dressed the way a lot of kids dressed at the time, you know?
Yeah. No, I think that's the thing about them that, and that's why people are always so fascinated by them, is because it's a band that, you know, like, once again, like you were saying earlier, everyone's like, oh, it was so simple what they were doing. Everything's so simple. Yeah. It's like, no, there's a lot of rules, and there's a lot of thought that went into
a lot of great songwriting, a lot of great lyrics.
Absolutely. And once again, a band that's timeless. Like, you can put on those records and they still sound fresh.
Yeah. It's interesting that, you know, that handful of bands, the music is the legacy, and kind of it's indoors. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it's also like, when a band can live the gimmick that long. I had dinner with Johnny in high school, and meeting him as like, just as a kid, and having this like very long dinner where he's telling me like, yeah, I never practiced. He's like, I'm never going to pick up a guitar again.
I have
no reason to ever do that. And just,
I mean, that's interesting. I suppose it's very punk, you know, it was a means to an end for him, but that's really not where I was coming from as a musician. You know, I mean, I did want to be successful, but I think first and foremost, I enjoy playing music. You know, I mean, I do all these offshoot bands, you know, for fun and just for the music. And, you know, it's just what I do. It's always what I've done. I guess Johnny, he just kind of picked up the guitar and made it, you know, his entree into the world he wanted to be in without having to actually work, you know. So I know, although it was hard work, obviously, with the Ramones. But I think Dee Dee kind of, for the most part, got kind of upset with the, you know, when he branched out, he tried to be a rap artist, which was kind of a joke. But he didn't really want to be stuck in that that sort of format forever, I think. And also, when I was in the band, Joey and I would talk about expanding things a little bit, you know. But it was so weird sitting in the band because, you know, famously, the two of them didn't speak to one another any longer. So Johnny would be in the front with the tour manager, Monty Melnick, and then I would sit in the next row, and then Joey was behind me, and then Dee Dee would be in the back. And I would just kind of really talk to Joey most of the time. We were friends, you know.
Yeah.
Good guy. Yeah.
Rest in peace.
Absolutely. And then the politics, you know, between Johnny and Joey, it's just crazy.
Yeah. I think that once again sets up a lot of the dichotomy that exists in punk too, with people on both extremes existing in the same music. But when CJ was on the show, he talked about how the speed of the band really affected Joey, and how he never wanted to play this fast, but with Johnny it was always fast. It had to be
it was
fast.
Like, he wanted to get off stage as quickly as possible. I mean, I did Mike Watt and I did the show, the 40th anniversary of the first album, and when it was decided that he and I were going to be the bass player and the drummer, I had never really met Mike before, although I, you know about the Minutemen and all that. I got in touch with him and said, hey, you know, you want to do this? He goes, yeah, let's rehearse. So like, we spent a week, just he and I, playing along to the first album. And then after we had everything committed to memory, just going into Mike's studio in Pedro and just playing the album over and over, you know, the music of the album over and over, the songs from the album over and over. And then by the time we got to New York, there were people that had that other idea. Oh yeah, this is easy. I'm just going to play Ramon's song. And we're like, no, wait a minute, guys. You know, we're doing this way. And because we had really spent quite a bit of time, and you know, and I got Craig Leon came on to play Farfisa on Let's Dance, which he did on the first album. But it kind of, for me, it kind of verified or, you know, legitimized what I was thinking all along. If I only had a chance to rehearse with the Ramones, it would have been great. Yeah. But it was complete trial by fire. You know? But yeah. It was great that Mark came back. Mark and I are friends. I just saw Mark in Ibiza. We did a DJ gig together in Ibiza, believe it or not. But I was playing like Motown and garage rock and stuff, and Mark was playing like YMCA and like blowing whistles and stuff, and dressed in his black leather jacket. It was kind of incongruous in that regard, but we had a good time being there. It's an interesting place to be.
Well, different styles, I guess, to this day.
Yeah, right. Mark is great. I saw his band Dust back when he had that sort of heavy metal band Dust, and of course Mark played with Wayne County back at Club 82. He's somebody that I've known for a very long time.
Wow. And I guess the Dust is another band that I think has gotten a lot more love these days from record collectors and stuff like that, right, on their probably. Own, completely independent from Ramon.
Right. Right.
Well, you talked about it earlier and I got to ask you about it. What was it like playing with Iggy for those years and, you know, finally getting to play with this band that kind of inspired you, or the person who from this band that kind of inspired you to enter this journey?
Well, the tour I did with Iggy was a 6-week tour that came about. I was working with Jimmy Destri on his solo record that he made during the Blondie break, and one of the guitarists on that record was Carlos Alomar from David Bowie's band, right? So it was an album called Rock and Roll Party that I guess Iggy had been promoting, and for whatever reason they needed a drummer, and he also asked Carlos to do it. And then I remember Carlos called me up and said, are you going to do this? And I said, yeah. And he goes, well, if you're going to do it, I'm going to do it. So we went on tour and we played some amazing gigs. Well, I remember when we played in San Francisco, Allen Ginsberg turned up and we were like hanging out with him and he's like chanting before we go on and things like that. And famously we opened two nights for the Rolling Stones Iggy's home ground, Pontiac Silverdome, like 70,000 people indoors. It was Iggy, Santana, and the Stones with no sound check for Iggy. And before the days of metal detectors, so we got pelted with all kinds of stuff. And Iggy was just on the edge of the stage, like taking it all in. And, you know, it was great. That tour was really good because it was a selection across the board, everything from the first Stooges album into the Idiot album, into the Lust for Life album, into the Rock and Roll Party album that he was promoting. It was probably the most fun. I mean, I've gone on the mandate for Iggy was play as loud and as fast as possible. You know, that's what he would awesome. Tell us to do. So it was really great. It was great. You know, and then of course our first national tour with Blondie was supporting Iggy with David Bowie on keyboards when they had made the Idiot record, and we got invited to be the opening act. That was amazing. That's where our connection with David began and with Iggy, you know. But it was really inspiring and to play with Iggy with a big time. And luckily that's captured on this video, this company Target. They recorded mm-hmm. one of our shows in San Francisco, and people always talk about that when I meet them, you know, people that are more interested into Iggy and the punk rock thing than the whole sort of Blondie side of things. So that was great. It was really a great experience working with him.
It's funny because I opened for him. I opened for the Stooges when the day after they had all their gear stolen in Montreal and all their shit ripped off. And they were.
This was when Mike was playing bass, right?
When Mike was playing bass, exactly. Right, yeah. And they came in the next night, and we expected them to just be, you know, licking wounds kind of thing. But they came out, and it was unbelievable, like one of the greatest shows I've ever seen in my life. And there was someone there, like a bunch of people there from Detroit that saw him back in the day, and they were like, they were unhinged. And it's almost like Iggy thrives from adversity. Like there's legendary Bad Stooges shows that are bootlegs where you hear him and it's almost like he's relishing in the fact that he's got that much effect on a crowd in the negative way too.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I remember on that video, he says something like, well, if he's like miming strumming a guitar, and he's like, if you can pretend this is a guitar, I can pretend you're an audience, you know, things like that, you know, something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really great with the one liners. When he did that song, Winter of My Discontent, which is not on the video we were doing, and you said, this is a song I co-wrote with Bill Shakespeare, you know, things like that. You know, that's a great song.
Yeah. Keith Morris, when he saw the Stooges on their last kind of run the first time around, he said that Iggy got dumped a thing of water on himself and then grabbed the microphone and zapped himself unconscious. And then
that's pretty outrageous. Yeah.
And yeah, just, you know, for someone to be able to do that and still do it on that level all these years later, it's like the gods amongst men type thing.
Yeah. We're actually talking about maybe next year, trying to do some shows, Blondie and Iggy together again.
Oh, that'd be amazing.
Yeah, I think it would be good. There's a bunch of different artists that are still around that we think would be great to kind of hook up with, the way similar we did to with Johnny Marr. Mm-hmm. Just was our special guest in the UK on this tour we just did, and then when we toured with Garbage, and we like to, and then the tour that we're doing now, you know, the Damned are our support act, this tour that's just about to happen with Blondie.
That's so, not coming here. I wish that was coming here,
right? Oh, it's kind of just the East Coast, and so we're playing Nashville and Chicago, Detroit.
Yeah, that would be amazing.
Closest, yeah.
But if you do that tour with Iggy, you got to do Repo Man together.
Well, yeah, that was good. That was good with Steve, and yeah, that was a good one.
This has been unbelievable. And anytime, Clem, you want to come back on the show and talk about punk or Josh Cantor or or anything, know that you're always welcome.
Okay, Damien, thank you very much, and it was great talking to you. And yeah, I guess we're supposed to be plugging this Against the Odds box set that's coming out actually Friday. It's really for Blondie super fans, and we also coincidentally just recorded a new album, so we're looking back and looking forward at the same time. So there'll be a new Blondie album next year, so we'll give it another 18 months.
Well,
been
come back
since the 70s. So.
Yeah, the last record was unbelievable. I think
Pollinator. Yeah.
Yeah. I think as a band, it's great to see continuing to put out classic albums.
Yeah. Yeah. That was kind of our mandate when we got back together in the late 90s, was we had to start making new music again. So thanks a lot for your time. Appreciate it. And I've caught your podcast many times. It's a great show. Keep up the good work.
Oh my gosh. Well, now you're leaving me blushing. Can you believe it? Clem Burke listens to this podcast. How wild is that? Thank you, Clem, for coming on the show. And hopefully Clem will be back for a part two at some point in the future, because there's a lot more stories to get to with that guy. Holy geez. Talk about a legend. Once again, you can grab that Blondie box set now. It is worth the time, and you will dive into this thing and probably get lost in this thing. It looks, as I said off the top, it looks pretty comprehensive in 74 to 82. Not that Blondie ever got bad, but like that is my, oh, I love that period of Blondie. Anyway, that is it. Coming up on the next episode of the show, you heard him talk about him on this episode. Monty Melnick will be on the show next week. Monty is, of course, the legendary tour manager of the Ramones, also the author of On the Road with the Ramones, an incredible book. If you've never seen this thing, you got to pick it up. It's been reissued again with more stories in it, but holy jeez, there are some wild stories in that thing. And yeah, Monty's on the show, and we talk punk. What else are we going to talk about? And we talk about like proto-punk and some other stuff too, because, you know, it's all under the umbrella. But that is it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives and issues of Indigenous peoples all over the world matter. We need to protect trans kids and help trans people protect themselves and stop hate and violence towards people of different races and different faiths, because these aren't political issues. These are basic human rights. People deserve to be able to live freely without hate or violence or discrimination. So
get involved in organizations that are affecting positive change in these areas. And I also add to this, and I'm not just, this is happening in Canada, it's happening all over the world, but I add to this, we need to help protect people's rights to choose what they want to do with their reproductive systems, because there are people coming for these things. There's people coming for these rights, and not just in America, it's happening in Canada. I'm sure it's happening in other places in the world. I'm sure I know there's plenty of places in the world where people don't have the right to choose what they want to do with their reproductive system. So once again, get involved in organizations, lend your time, if you've got money to spare, I'm sure there's funding for these things that need to happen, and just get involved. It'll make you feel a little bit better. Speaking of feeling a little bit better, try meditating. I didn't believe in it, and now I try it, and it kind of works for me a little bit. So maybe it'll work for you. What's the worst that can happen? You just don't like it, you don't do it again. Boom. Maybe try it a couple times, because it took a while for me to kind of connect to it too. Make your own culture. Anyone can do this stuff. Start a band, start a fanzine, start a podcast, whatever you want to do. Just exercise some creative outlet. I don't know if doing a podcast is very creative, but maybe yours will be more creative than mine. I don't know if mine's necessarily my creative outlet, but it's fun. I love doing it. I learn every single time, and I've gotten to meet a lot of people on this last tour that also enjoy it. So thank you to everyone who's come up and talked to me about it. I really appreciate that. And sign your organ donor cards, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore. It's just literally dead weight at that point. So donate them, and it can give someone a new life, a chance to live. I've seen it happen firsthand. So please sign those organ donor cards. And that is it. Stay safe. Thanks for listening. And I'll be home next week. And bye.